Hello, Canadian television nerds. My name is Greg David, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, my conversation with Karen McClellan. Karen McClellan is an executive producer and co-showrunner of The Next Step, Family Channel's number one rated series and an international hit, which has garnered multiple BAFTA awards and Canadian Screen Award nominations. Karen's other credits cover an array of drama and comedy, including the award-winning series Cracked, Being Erica, and Robson Arms. She has developed 1 hour and half hour shows for all of the major Canadian broadcasters. She's been nominated for several Writers Guild of Canada awards for her work and won the award for her web series Spiral. She is an alumna of the American Film Institute. We'll hear all about this and Hallmark movies and more in my conversation with Karen McClellan. All right. Well, Karen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. It's funny because on social media, your Twitter handle is it's New McClellan, and also on Skype, and that keeps messing me up.
Oh yeah. Well, some jerk named Karen McClellan already took the Twitter handle and Instagram, so I went with a nickname that some friends gave me a while ago, and I haven't figured out how to reclaim like the Karen McClellan.
What's the story behind the nickname? Is it an interesting story? Is it a racy story?
I wish. No. I don't know. My friend Aaron Martin, who I know you're acquainted with.
Yeah.
Another friend, Nicole Hamilton, and I were going off on a trip many, many years ago, and the two of them had nicknames for each other and decided that I should be called New.
Oh.
And so it kind of stuck. And there you go. So that's, and I just for consistency's sake have adopted New McClellan as my social media handle.
Well, there you go. There's some breaking news from the world of social media and nicknames. You already mentioned Aaron Martin. He and I both grew up in the same city and actually went to the same high school. We were a year or two apart. But now looking at your IMDb page, I see The Best Years, which is a show that Aaron created. So is that when you first got into the business? What's your origin story?
Oh, I have a long sorted origin story, but if you want me to confine it to writing, I mean, you know what? For anybody who cares to hear the story, I'll just say that for some writers, they know out of the gate what they want to do, and I knew out of the gate what I wanted to do, and then it took about 10 years to get really on track.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean, you know, like at a young age, I knew I loved writing. And then for my undergrad, I went to U of T and majored in sociology and semiotics, which I guess you can apply those studies to writing for sure. But I didn't go to film school.
Right.
And then I started working in the film industry as a PA and, did stints as a production coordinator. I worked for some high-powered Hollywood A-listers and A-list producers as their assistants.
Ooh.
And that was certainly an education.
Yeah.
Gail-Ann Hurd being one of them.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, learned invaluable lessons about the business from them. And then had an opportunity to work on a show as a script coordinator, and that was certainly a learning experience. But at the time, I thought, I need to devote myself to writing. Mm-hmm. And so I got a day job in development, which I thought would allow me time to write, and it did not. So I really had no social life for a long time. And I just share that because, you know, I think for any writer starting out, I don't know. I don't know what other people think. So why should even begin there? I would sometimes look at the trajectory, of other people, think, wow, they, you know, boy, what are they doing that I'm not? And right. I think it's just sweat. It's just sweat and keeping your butt in the chair. But anyway, I very quickly discovered that this development gig was like tearing me away from writing. Mm-hmm. And, but I had a very, very supportive boss who really supported me, taking, you know, some time to write. And so when I applied to the American Film Institute and actually got in, she was very supportive. And, you know, I left that job and I moved to California with very little notice, to do, the 2-year graduate program down in the States. And even then, you know, you would think, oh, and then you just walked into a TV show and started writing, and that wasn't the case.
Right.
I came back to Canada for family reasons. Uh-huh. And I am not too proud to admit that I was depressed and probably lay on a couch for a good 4 months while I was like, what am I doing back here? And, you know, what happened?
Yeah.
And then I went to the Film Center, and the Film Center was a real turning point, the Canadian Film Center.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm probably, you know, uniquely qualified to speak to most of the training institutions. In Canada and the States. But the Film Center, and sorry, I know I'm digressing and giving you a very long answer to the origin story, but AFI was really focused on features at the time that I went there.
Okay.
And they've since become a school that has really opened up to television, television writing, and making sure that their writers come out really like with strong samples in TV because they know that's where the work is. Mm-hmm. And so now a good friend of mine is a teacher there, and as well as a working writer, and a lot of his students have gone on to, you know, run shows, be staff, like they're kicking ass and they're taking numbers versus the directors who are not having the same level of success because it's still a feature centric school for directors and there's just not the work.
Right.
So anyway, fast forward to the Canadian Film Center. Yeah. I went there. I had the excellent fortune of being put into Shelley Erickson's room. So at the time, it was Shelley Erickson and Cal Coons, and each of them were running their own rooms.
Wow.
Lucked out, and I got into Shelley Erickson's room. Cal is amazing. I'm sure it would have been a lucky break to meet him too.
Yeah.
But then Shelley gave me my big break as a script coordinator on Show Me Yours. And while I was, you know, between graduating the Film Center and getting that opportunity, I started working on a project of my own with Nicole Hamilton, who was roommates with Aaron Martin. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, Nicole and I set up that project at CTV, and that was a pilot that turned into a 3-script order. And that really was a way for me to showcase my voice. And that script, I mean, really turned things around for me. I found my stride and then worked on a couple of half-hour shows. And then Aaron Martin, who I knew socially, mm-hmm. and I know Aaron is a very discerning writer and very, you know, he's a very loyal guy and he's got his group of writers, but he had read my project called Rebound and invited me to be part of the best years. And, you know, it was an amazing opportunity and he's been a fantastic mentor to me over the years. Because of Aaron, I was able to get a lot of on-set experience mm-hmm. on the best years, which yeah. I think is key for any writer. And that has really, you know, allowed me to flourish as a writer and producer and a supervising producer and now as a showrunner on The Next Step. And by showrunner, I mean co-showrunner.
Right, right.
But yeah, so I owe Aaron and Shelley a huge debt of gratitude.
I want to go back to your time when you were in LA, because when you mentioned the name Gail Ann Hurd, of course, everybody now thinks of the Walking Dead. What did your, you know, without getting, you know, not asking you to open up and talk necessarily about, you know, anything that happened out in LA personally or anything, but what is the LA experience? How did that kind of build that foundation for what you've got in your kind of in your toolbox today? That must have been an incredible experience being in LA at that time.
It really was. And when I met Gail, she was up here working, she was producing an HBO movie called Sugar Time. Mm-hmm. And, I was incredibly green. Like, I mean, this was like the second or third gig I had in the business. She's a brilliant woman. She is a brilliant woman. And, I guess what I can say about that experience is just like, she is fearless. She is super smart. She knows her brand.
Yeah.
You know, and, God, I wish I had a taste for zombie stories and horror and action films, because that would have been a fantastic fit, but that's just not my sound, and I'm comfortable with that. Yeah. I really appreciate the brilliance of The Walking Dead,
yeah,
and all of the work that she's done, The Abyss and The Aliens and Terminator and everything. But I think, you know, to summarize the LA experience, you have a lot of, I mean, LA is a business, so
yeah.
You know, everybody treats it that way. And there's a kind of meritocracy to it, like mm-hmm. best idea wins. Mm-hmm. And people just hustle. Mm-hmm. They hustle, hustle, hustle. And I think there's something really exciting about being around people that are always talking about the business and making things better. And, you know, that's why I go to the Toronto Screenwriting Conference every year, because there's always something to learn. There's always something that I need to look at in my work. I mean, sorry, I know I digress, but it circles back to your question about LA, but mm-hmm. there was the workshop from Corey Mandel, who I've taken classes from.
Yeah.
And maybe I just like a class setting. I'm just, you know what? I'm just a schoolgirl. I like my classes. But I found his 2-hour workshop about opening, you know, designing your opening scene so
yes.
relevant to a project that I'm writing right now, where the producer bumped on the opening scene, just had a like, can we do something a little different here? And, you know, that's a fresh note. And I sat in that class, and actually it was David Shore's talk before then about hooking your audience. I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. I need a hook.
Yeah.
A hook. I need a really good hook in here, and I haven't got that yet. So I felt really good about figuring out those solutions. But what you get in LA, and you do get it here in Canada, it's just that when you're in LA, you're in a city of 14 million people, and you're dialed into a community of people who are just hustling and they're working, and there's just a different level of passion. I think, I mean, I'm talking blanket. Everyone that I've worked with in the business here in Canada is certainly passionate. Like, you have to be passionate.
Yeah.
About what you do to be in this business. But I just mean like it's, I don't know. It's like comparing it's so cliched. It's like the opportunities are greater. The competition is greater. It's just, it's Rome in its heyday. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Talking about the entertainment business.
You already mentioned the Toronto Screenwriting Conference, and depending on when this podcast goes up, it'll either be a week after the events or a couple of days after the Toronto Screenwriting Conference. And yeah, I saw you there while I was moderating the digital series panel. I was in Corey's panel when he was talking about the character's Heart of Darkness. I was there when David Shore was talking about, you know, making your characters blunt. So maybe what you need to do in your opening is have somebody step up and say, "You're killing him." Is there a way that you can work that into your opening? But, you know, you already said that you go back every year, and I guess it's like any craft, right? You can never just say, okay, well, I know how to do this now, and I don't need to go back and be inspired by other people and kind of be in a room with a bunch of creative people. You still need to do that to be inspired, don't you?
I do. I mean, it's just always, I don't know, for those 2 days, I get a whole flood of ideas. And whether or not I go back to the notes, because I always end up taking lots of notes and recording and everything. But, you know, it's just something settles inside of me. And, like, I will go back to the project that I'm working on currently and take a look at those opening scenes better and really think about the Heart of Darkness and really think about, you know, how are my characters opposing each other? Like, how are they diametrically opposed? You know, in the way that Walter and Jesse are diametrically opposed in Breaking Bad. And, you know, that's something that I'll take with me to, you know, another season of The Next Step. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's these things that you hear along the way. Like when I worked on a project called The Other Kingdom and I was working with Tom Lynch, and Tom is amazing and wonderful. And in many ways, sort of like this, you know, mad scientist genius type who comes into the room and he's got all these big ideas and he has this infectious laugh. And the big mantra that I really absorbed from my time with him was just like, what's the surprise? Like, keep surprising me.
Right.
And, you know, as I've moved on, I've been like, you know, I look at the act breaks and you know, on a run of The Next Step, like we're breaking, well, season 5, we broke 20 episodes.
Yeah.
Season 6 was 26. So, you know, there's 46. That's a really awesome amount of practice.
Yeah.
And I feel so fortunate to, because, you know, it was like, okay, where's the surprise? That's a good story, but where's the hook? What's going to hook us? And then, you know, just going to the conference is just a really great way of just keeping those muscles limber, because, you know, as you know, in the business, and any writer listening to this knows, you have your intense moments when you're hopefully in production on a project and you're going hard and you're using this muscle. And then you have your fallow period when you're developing your own stuff, where you're, you know, eating chips late at night, wondering if you're ever going to work again. But late at night, it doesn't feel like you will.
Right.
You have to do something to, like, and it, I just, like, I don't know. I just really enjoy it. I like it. I get something out of it. And, you know, hearing Stacey Rookhiser, sorry, I'm going to mispronounce her last name, but hearing her talk about her experience on Unreal and talk about how to make the unlikable female protagonist likable, such a, I mean, I can't say enough, but it's a feeling of solidarity to be like, wow, okay, awesome. I'm sad that she goes through that, but I also at the same time feel like, oh, wow. You know, like I feel a solidarity, of like, oh yeah. Yeah. Like, okay. Someone at her level, she goes through that and gets those notes, and those notes come in all sorts of different ways. So it's just, it's really useful professional development to also hear how other people deal with the same issue in the different language, because, you know, a few years ago it would, you know, it's like what's the save the cat moment. And right. Now that's the cat moment is like, well, what is your character defining moment? What is that? You know, like everybody has a different way of talking about it. Corey Mandel has a way of talking about designing that opening scene as like seeing character, concept and premise all in the same scene. And Blake Snyder, you know, might have framed it as, well, you need that save the cat moment. And, you know, and then like, anyway, there's just, I think the value in going to these conferences year after year is that as you grow as a writer, honing your tools and everything, you just need more. And sometimes you just need, to hear it phrased differently.
Right.
Sense.
Oh yeah, yeah, totally, totally. Even if you're just all there in the same room, kind of commiserating and nodding your head at the same things that annoy David Shore.
Yeah, yeah, and yes, because I've gone on the tirade of like, let's get rid of all the looks and
yes,
the just.
Yeah,
just. I mean, I have so many justs and those all those words have to come out. And you know, there was a podcast that I listened to with Brian Koppelman, and he was interviewing a woman. I wish I could remember her name. She's a chef and she's a writer. And she talked about how being a chef improved her writing, that it really all came down to minimalism and just being so spare with the word. And I think that is really the big takeaway that I took from this particular screenwriting conference, was being very spare with the word, trusting your audience, in that you don't have to, you can have your characters speak plainly, but have them assert themselves and take out all the fluff, take out the fluff at the beginning of the scene, take out the fluff at the end of the scene, like really look at what the scene is about. And, if you don't have an opportunity to practice that in an edit room, like Rachel Schaefer and I do often on, The Next Step, we're just paring everything down, like paring things down. Our season finale for season 6, we had 3 episodes come in at, like, we wanted to deliver at 45 minutes. And our delivery time was 22.
Oh, wow.
We spent a few weeks going back and forth. Like, could we deliver an extra episode? Could we deliver, a full half hour, and you kind of kick the can and come at them a few different ways. What about this? What about that? You know, like, it's a very special, season finale or something like that. And God love them, the networks were like, no, we need you to bring this to time.
Yeah.
So we did. And that was such an exercise of, just what is the story that you're going to tell? And if it doesn't support that story, it goes. And right. So we left a lot of darlings on the floor. But in the end, I don't miss them. I mean, I do.
Right.
Do you think that if we could have had them in, it would? Yeah. But you know what? No. It's fine. And so to go to the screenwriting conference is just to, like, I don't know. It's sort of It's just a good reminder of, this is what we have to do. This is what you have to do to work at this level, to elevate your game, to just get better and better and better.
Going through your IMDb page, have you written episodes of a lot of shows that people have seen over the years? We already talked about The Best Years, but also you wrote an episode of Robson Arms. You've also written for Being Erica, reunited with Aaron Martin, Cracked. Loved Cracked and was sad when it went away from CBC, because I really thought they were doing something special with that show. But something on your IMDb page that's very interesting is the TV movie Charming Christmas. And it's interesting to me because it wasn't until this past Christmas when I was watching the W Network, because I have that as part of my cable package, that the power of the Hallmark Christmas movie. Because through the month of December, I was able to tune in and watch several of these Christmas movies that were, somewhat formulaic, but they're damn enjoyable to sit and watch. And before you know it, you've gone through a whole month and you've seen a lot of Lacey Chabert cast in a lot of these movies. But they really, really are enjoyable. So what was your experience adapting Charming Christmas into a Hallmark TV movie?
Oh, Hallmark is great. They really know their audience.
Yeah.
And I know that Hallmark Christmas movies, like, I know people like to make fun of them, but they really are just they're like a really nice warm hug, yeah. A lovely cup of hot cocoa.
Yep.
And there's just something, especially at Christmas, something really enjoyable about, dare I say, a wholesome movie. Like, mm-hmm. It can be like, you know what? All is well in the world.
Yeah.
In this particular little place, good things happen. And I can only say of my Hallmark experience is that I've had a wonderful time. Anytime I get an opportunity to work with Lissy Ost at Hallmark, I mean, she's a great executive. And I've really had, I mean, A Charming Christmas was a movie. It was originally a book.
Yes.
That John Eskenaz, the producer, brought to me. And I've had such a great working relationship with John. We go back to a movie that I wrote out of AFI called Bridal Fever. The
yep.
original draft preceded, I would like to say, this was well before Bridesmaids. And Bridesmaids was probably what that would have been the movie that I would have loved to have written.
Right.
At the time. And the draft of Bridesmaids that he read, I mean, it had some very racy material. There may have been a golden shower joke in there. and Hallmark, they read that draft, which was remarkable. And then I did complete page one rewrite because they loved the concept and they're like, you know, make it for Hallmark. So I did. So any kind of racy jokes, even a joke about orgasms, like a food tasting orgasmic, went out the window. And that's just fine because,
yeah.
Again, the beauty of Hallmark is that they know their audience, and their audience is a mom in her 30s, maybe in her 40s, who has kids, probably young kids, and, you know, she just wants to chill out,
mm-hmm.
watch her movie. Maybe she's doing some crafting. Maybe she's, like, chilled out from, like, marking papers or whatever.
Yeah.
And she doesn't want to have to answer any questions. And this is something that I really understood after they were like, yeah, you can't describe cheesecake as being orgasmic because if a kid walks into the room at the time that your character is describing food as orgasmic and that child turns to mom and says, what does orgasmic mean? Now you put our audience on the hook to answer a question that she doesn't want to answer. She just wanted to turn on the channel to enjoy herself. And I love that clarity. And I think it's, I fully embrace what they're doing. I mean, I think it's great. And I really, I mean, would that we all knew are like, you know, they really do know their audience mm-hmm. and their audience needs and what they want. And those Christmas movies, I mean, they're fun.
Yeah.
Fun.
Yep. Okay. With the amount of writing that you've done for television, it was interesting. You and I first spoke, I think it was when we were discussing Spiral. So what has that been like? Again, getting back to the Toronto Screenwriting Conference, I was moderating a panel on the digital space, and that's the first time that the Toronto Screenwriting Conference has had a panel where creators are talking about digital series. As a writer for several TV series and then a couple of TV movies, what was it like? What was the difference like writing Spiral, which was a web series? Was that a new learning experience for you as a writer, or because of what you had already done, was it fairly easy? How did that happen? How did that go?
Well, Spiral took a long time. So Spiral, it was an idea that Andrew Williams and I had. He came to me with an idea, and then together we really expanded that idea. And that, I would say, was really about 10 years ago. And at the time, we were, like, thinking about how people watch TV and they use different screens. And at the time, screens were I don't know. I can't even remember if we were really into iPads or...
10 years ago, I don't think so.
Yeah. But we were just, like, thinking, like, everybody's on their cell phone, and we had all sorts of ideas. But anyway, to cut to the chase, Spiral had been in development for a very long time. And in 2011, I think, we had some money to get a room together and write some scripts. And at the time, it was just like, you know what, guys, we're just going blue sky this. And so we had different past lives in every episode. So for anyone who doesn't know Spiral, a group of college-age students realize after one of them turns up dead that they are connected through a past life. And they have to figure out what that connection is before the killer strikes again. So in the original iteration of the web series, we had a past life in every episode. Mm. And that's just not going to fly on a small budget. Mm-hmm. So I think I might have lost track or gone off the ranch with this answer. But what did I learn? I mean, through the years, from the time that Andrew and I started talking about past lives and his idea about college friends who shared a dream, you know, I had come through a lot of production and saw, like, you know, the wisdom in choosing one past life and, like, tell a story and really think about, you know, how much time do you have? What is your budget? What can you realistically accomplish? And what's the most interesting way to tell the story mm-hmm. in those constraints? So I think that was really helpful. And then from sort of like a personal place, I would say, like, I mean, my IMDb page is varied. You yeah. have Hallmark movies.
Yeah.
And I do love me a good Hallmark Christmas movie. I do. Mm-hmm. And I love rom-coms. And I, you know, Being Erica was a great show to work on and that whole concept. And then, you know, there's 13, the series.
Yeah.
All action.
Yeah.
And, like, totally different, which is something I was so ecstatic to do because I didn't want to be known as the girl who only wrote wedding movies and could only do, like, soft relationships. And I think, you know, people are multi-layered and I have multiple interests. I mean, my Twitter feed might seem a little schizophrenic because, you know, one day I'm ranting about politics and the next I'm like, hey guys, next up, and reposting lots of writer tips.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so Spiral was really, you know, I really wanted to explore, you know, something a little darker than I normally get a chance to with some of the shows that I have been doing up to this point. And the really cool thing, cool part of the experience and daunting part of the experience is that TELUS really didn't have any creative notes. So that was, you know, exciting because I think traditionally writers go, there's too many notes and notes.
Right.
Generally, and I'm not saying this just to sound politic, I rely on notes to be my side view mirrors,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, to be like, okay, oh, I missed this here. Oh, great. And, you know, I would say 10 times out of 10, the note has always made the project better.
Wow.
So when TELUS said, oh, we don't have any notes, just don't swear as much.
Right.
Or give us a bleeped out version. I was like, okay. And then I got scared because I'm like, shit, you know, if this is really terrible, it's all on me. Like, I don't have anybody else to blame. I can't, like,
right.
I can't say, oh, well, you know, I was just trying to address a note.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was scary. And I'm really glad that, you know, Andrew and I and the cast and the director and the other producers, Annalise and Lisa and our whole cast and crew, everybody poured their hearts into this. And, you know, when I look back on it, I feel personally, like, for me to watch Spiral now, I feel Like, a very good friend of mine was ill at the time and passed away just before shooting. And so I feel a little sadness. And, you know, I think, oh, that's, like, I guess it just sort of seeped in there. And, you know, the weather conspired. I was like, I remember telling our director, I don't want this to be a Scandi noir. Like,
right.
And then the weather in Victoria, it was supposed to be spring. It was, it was always blustery and overcast. And so it tended to infuse the whole series with this, like, I don't know, quality that wasn't my intention. But then again, going back to the big takeaway that we heard this weekend at the Toronto Screenwriting Conference is, like, you write it three times. You write the draft, then you have the production, and then you're in post. And that's your third time to write the draft. So anyway, I'm sorry. I lost track of what.
No, that's okay. You answered the question. And it was very atmospheric. And when I spoke to Jill Carter about her experience, she loved it. She loved the fact that, you know, the weather wasn't always cooperating and that you guys were on such a tight budget. She really, she said that it was a challenge for her as a director and that she really loved it. She loved the experience.
Yeah. Well, she was a trooper. I mean, she really was. Everybody was. And we didn't have, like, you couldn't throw money at the problem.
Right.
And you couldn't buy time. We were on a location that was very sensitive, mm-hmm. like very, very sensitive. And we had to be out of there at a certain time. So, you know, some of these luxuries that you get used to when you're working in bigger productions where you can go over by an hour because you basically own the studio, or, you being the production company, like, you know, you have the studio, or you're in a more film experienced town where they're like, yeah, of course, like, we're used to this.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have that.
Yeah.
We didn't have that. But it really did make everything lean and efficient, and the cast really pulled together, and yeah, everybody. And Jill, you know, worked miracles with the schedule and getting all the shots. Like, I think we pretty much got everything.
Yeah.
We got everything that was on the page. And, you know, Andrew and I have marveled at, you know, in hindsight, how ambitious it was. So, I mean, given it was a 10-day shoot and we had, like, very little money.
Right, right. When you write, are you the type of person that can write in a coffee shop with noise? Do you need a quiet room? Do you play music? Do you have a lucky mug of tea with you? How does the writing come for you?
A variation of all of that. I prefer quiet. But I also can get very distracted when I'm working at home by myself.
Yeah.
So I do find, I like the white noise of a coffee shop, and I've narrowed down, like, the two Starbucks where I'm most productive. So I would say, I'm pretty suspicious about where I work when it comes superstitious.
Right.
And also suspicious, too. I've had a negative experience at the Leslieville Starbucks, not by the staff, but by some of the other customers that, you know, could brush up on their social skills.
Ooh.
But, yeah, you cannot reserve an outlet. I just want to put that out there.
Ugh.
Or the person who asks someone to unplug their computer because you've reserved that outlet, you're a D-bag.
Whoa.
I digress. No, I do. I get superstitious. There are a couple of coffee shops that I like to work at. I have had lucky mugs in the past, but I'm not married to any of them anymore. But sometimes you just do what you have to do. Like, on Friday, I needed to turn in an outline,
mm-hmm.
and my son's, his preschool year had finished,
yeah.
and they were having a celebration ceremony at his little school,
yeah.
on Friday morning. So I woke up at 5:30 so I could, like, dot all the I's, cross all the T's, make sure, you know, I just cleaned up the last bit of this outline. And I thought, you know, I'll be golden because this, he'll till 7:30. My husband will get up. He's taking the day off for this. No, no. I mean, my son woke up at 6 a.m. and was like, Mama, come sleep in the room with me. And so, I mean, I don't know how I did it, but I brought in my computer. And you just, sometimes you just do what you have to do. So yeah. If you have to write in a really busy coffee shop, like you just like, I guess, you just laser focus and you have to do this. And just going back to Spiral.
Sure.
I mean, there was a scene that was so obviously not working when we blocked it. It was like, oh God, I didn't look at this last night. Why didn't I look at this last night? Probably because I was prepping the wardrobe for the day.
Hmm.
But, so like, then you're just rewriting on the spot. And, so I guess in an ideal world, I write with silence. I find, music distracting. If I am getting distracted at home, I go work at a Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
I find the white noise good there. If I'm on a deadline, I write to act breaks. I don't give myself a page count. Like, I'm not like, ooh, okay, I've written 4 pages, I can knock off for the day.
Ah.
I'm like goal centric on like, no, I got to get to this act.
Right.
If I get to this act, then I'm screwed. And I sort of break it that way. And if, and then sometimes you just do what you have to do in order to get it done. And however that takes, like if it's phones or locking your family away in a bathroom. I mean, you know, you just do what you have to do.
It's so interesting. You have so many different ways of dealing. I think that's great. And it's so interesting as writers, how we trick ourselves. Like, you know, you say, okay, well, I'll work till the act break. And then I'm good. And I'll do the same thing. I'll say, okay, well, if I get up early and I work from 7:30 till like 2, then I won't feel guilty if I knock off for the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like you have to, I mean, it's all about, pace. Like when I'm in production, my day is, it's not enviable.
Mm.
I mean, it is, listen, what I do, I think, is enviable.
Yeah.
I love what I do, and
yeah.
I know that it's a huge privilege whenever I get the chance to do it. But I just mean, like, waking up at 5:30 or 6, 5:30,
mm-hmm.
so that you can get to set, so that you're there for 7, and call time is 7:30. And then with Next Step, Rachel and I are on set for, like, 12 hours,
mm-hmm.
and we're dividing our time between set, between the room. We kind of leave post alone for the most part, but we still check into post. But then we're there until like wrap, which is generally 7:30.
Yeah.
And then depending on where we're at with our scripts, we're back in the room. And if the room has broken, then we're doing our own heavy lifting. Like we're either writing our own outlines or we're rewriting other outlines. And then I typically go to bed at like 11.
Yeah.
Probably 12 if I'm being realistic.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel's much better at being, you know, good with herself and going to bed earlier. I've always been a night hawk, so I'm kind of my worst enemy. And then through the run of it, I'm working every weekend because I'm either writing my own outlines again or rewriting.
Yeah.
And that's how it goes. Like it's nonstop. And then even in post, because so much of Next Step is built in post, you know, those are still, well, they're a little nicer.
Right.
The day starts at like 9:30. Mm-hmm. And then goes until 6 or 7 or sometimes later, depending on what kind of deadlines we're on. But, you know, there's a good chunk of time where you give up a family and social life, which is fine. It is what it is. We're farmers. We
yeah.
make hay when we have hay to make.
Yeah.
During those fallow periods, then it's like, okay, well, another, you know, muscle that has to be worked is like that discipline of get up at 7, work until 2, and then also be gentle with yourself because you still have a life to manage.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
So
I don't know where I was going with that other than I was just just sort of venting.
It's good. That's all right. It's okay to vent. We're in a safe place. Give me the update on what's been going on. What's the status of the next step? Are you guys wrapped your latest season? You've already mentioned that you're working on some outlines. Anything that you can talk about?
Well, next up, season 6 premieres on BBC coming up imminently, the beginning of July.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll debut in the U.S. on Universal Kids. And then I believe Hulu in August, and then Family Channel sometime in the fall.
Yep.
They haven't released a date yet.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, we remain very hopeful that we'll, you know, hear about season 7 because we're excited to dig into season 7. We
yep.
have lots of ideas, and we're really, really excited about our cast. They're incredible, and we would love to keep this train going because it's such a fun show, and the dance, the passion, the teens, and just the stories that you get to tell. It's really fulfilling. So we are waiting to hear about season 7. So that's where that stands.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Spiral, you know, we are looking for funding.
Yep.
We've applied to some different funds. We're waiting to hear back. And something that was touched on at the digital panel is that financing a second season is a little trickier than financing your first season. And I think the big difference is your first season, you do burn up those favors.
Like, right.
We really leaned on a yeah. lot of people. Like, I don't think I could never ask our first AD, David Antoniak, to work for what he worked for. I could never do that. Not with a straight face. I can do that. Like, so, and he's just one example. Like, everybody, Jill, David, the actors, everybody. I mean, we called in every favor, and, so, you know, some feedback that we have gotten that I know other projects have received too is like, wow, you guys are asking for a lot of money for season 2. Like, what's the deal with that? You know, mm-hmm. like, because I can't beg and borrow and steal anymore. Like, I can't. So this is actually what a real budget, you know, this is a real cost. And I think there's a, you know, the downside of web series is that there's a perception that it just doesn't, you know, like, not a downside. I think the rock and the hard place is that we all know what good content looks like.
Right.
And you know, now we have that same expectation of web series mm-hmm. and digital series that they're going to be really slick and incredibly well produced. And that is the expectation. Well, to do that, you need to work at a, you know, you need a lighting package, a really keen DP, you know, directors. Like, that all costs money.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, now you're looking at like real costs of actually producing TV. But there's this expectation that, well, it's a web series, so it should be, you know, it shouldn't really cost that much.
Right.
But it's still the work. It's still the work. It's still the, you know. So anyway, high hopes that we get some funding there. And, you know, we've had positive nibbles and everything. And so it would be great if we could get that coming together. And I've been putting in thought to what a second season looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an idea. It's you know, unless the weather conspires against me to make it really moody, but you know, this is I would like to go back to my wheelhouse of romance, and I think if season 1 can be summed up as karma, I want to look at season two as redemption, but redemption through love. So so I have some ideas for something that's still, you know, gripping and a mystery, but I really would like to explore a more emotional story for season two. So, you know, hopefully we'll get the coin and we can pull it off, because I know the cast would be into it, and it would be fun to see that through. I'd love to see it through.
Okay. And last question, despite the challenges that you've spoken about for the last 40, 45 minutes or so, because there is, you know, it's a struggle to get things made in this country with a limited budget. What's the best part? What's your favorite part about working in the Canadian television industry?
Well, the people are really passionate. Like, the people who are up here, I mean, you know, listen, Boat Rocker are really forward thinking, you know, is a forward thinking company, and they really support their creators, and they're very, you know, I think those guys have always been at the forefront of really finding like interesting content. And, you know, Shaftesbury is another company that I think really supports creators. And, you know, the exciting thing is, like, they're good companies. They're really, really good companies. And they're two. They're just two. I mean, mm-hmm. I know there are a lot of other great companies out there. Those are, you know, Shaftesbury and Boat Rocker are ones that I'm very well acquainted with right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a global market. So, you know, forgive me if I sounded like a bit of a goof going, oh, LA, it's like everybody's there working on a different level. No, I mean, people up here are really like, everyone's committed. Everyone mm-hmm. that I have worked with, writers and directors, are really committed to making the best product possible. And the exciting thing, because I think we could, you know, all despair of like, oh, what's going on? And, you know, have we reached like maximum TV, and, you know, like networks aren't sure what they're doing. But the truth is, like, there's so many outlets for content right now. And I think what Canadians excel at is, you know, working with other people. None of us are daunted by co-productions. None of us are daunted by, you know, getting notes from a couple of networks. And we all know how to make something good on a budget and punch above our weight when it comes to making that budget look good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I mean, like being Erica and Orphan Black and Killjoys and oh my gosh, Flashpoint. Mm-hmm. I mean, those all fantastic, high quality shows, and with an E. Well, you know what? I can't even speak to that. So I have no idea what budget they have, but it looks amazing. But, you know, those are in the States. Those would be like, you know, double the amount.
Yeah.
And we're doing fantastic shows up here. And I think when you look at our batting average, we have more hits per times that we get up to bat than you do in the States. So I think what's really exciting about being here in Canada is that we may be a smaller pond, but maybe we're a deeper, mightier pond. I don't know. That sounds cheesy, but we just, like, I think if we, as creators and writers, just like, hold to our truth of, we have stories to tell and we know how to tell them. And there is a market around the world. This is a global market. I just wish that, oh, now I'm going to go on my soapbox, but it really irritates me when people say, ooh, the elites, and we've got to kill CBC.
Right.
And blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's a particular political party that usually likes to bang that drum, mm-hmm. and a particular right wing sort of spectrum. And I resent that because it's an economy, it's a business, and it employs, our business employs so many people, so many really talented people. I mean, you have Paul Osterberry, who designed, you know, the Fish movie. Sorry, I'm drawing a blank, but like, he's phenomenal. We have all that talent up here.
The Shape of Water?
Yes, The Shape of Water.
No problem.
Romantic comedy. Which I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And, you know, Guillermo is like awesome for supporting Toronto. Like, what a mensch he is. But that's what's exciting about Toronto. And also, like, we have an amazing city. Sorry, now I'm gassing on and I'm having a love affair with Toronto, but not the transit system, but Toronto. because we have diversity here.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, and we have, look, we, like, Degrassi, what an amazing export. I mean, I would love to just, I think when you see the politics happening around the world, not just in the States, but around the world, the great thing about working in Toronto is that we embrace each other and it comes through in our storytelling. And I think that is our strength. And I think we're just getting better. Like, being in rooms, like, we have to apprentice from each other. Writers, we have to do this. That, if LA had an edge, if it had an advantage, it's because it has years and years of people apprenticing and
right.
people being able to move up the ranks of the story room and learn and apprentice, because that is the thing. It really, it's a craft that you have to learn, and you have to learn by doing your mistakes and making them and being like, eh, okay, could have done better. And now I know, like, to hear Chip Johansson, talk about, you know, his trajectory from Millennium to 24 to Homeland, like, you're seeing the evolution of his career and his thought process when it comes to TV. And I think, you know, slowly, hopefully we're able to gain some ground like that in Canada with having those opportunities and with the, being able to, like, keep moving up and keep the brain trust here. Like, that's, anyway, sorry, I'm going on, but like that's the great thing about working in Canada is, you know, being afforded the opportunity to, like, you know, keep working, keep growing and, honing the craft. And I think if people are drawn to LA, and, you know, I certainly have been and would always consider going back there, but it's because you keep getting those opportunities. And I think ultimately, you know, many of us writers, or, well, I'll just speak for myself, I just want to keep getting better and tell the story and have the chance to keep doing what I do. It's not fun just doing it by yourself and not seeing it on the screen. I mean, it's okay, but then write a novel, you know? But that's hard work too. Like, it's all hard. Anyway.
A big thanks to Karen for taking the time to chat about her career with me. As always, you can find all of our podcasts at tba.com. You can just click on the podcast app, or, of course, you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple or Google Play. That wraps up another episode for this week, and now back to your regularly scheduled programming.